Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this week's workshop, which is all about inflammation and stress. Two topics Dr. Yasmina and I feel very passionately about because both of them can impact our health so significantly. Hi, Dr. Yasmina.
Hello, Amelia. Hello, everyone. And thank you again for giving us your very, very precious time.
Yes, well, I know we've got lots to get through today, Dr. Yasmina, and this is such a fascinating topic. And so what I'd like to do with today's session is to basically break it into two parts. So we're going to start with inflammation and a deep dive into our biomarkers relating to inflammation. And then for the second part, we're going to talk about stress, and we're going to go through all the symptoms of stress, how we can test our stress levels. Are we really stressed? Is it actually affecting us? And then, most importantly, what can we do about it? And how can we mitigate our stress and how inflammation and stress are tied together? All right. So, without further delay, kicking off with inflammation, Dr. Yasmina, can you firstly explain exactly what inflammation in our body is?
You know what? It's a healing mechanism. It's a response to injury. Your body's band-aid, really. So when you need to deal with infection, when you need to deal with injury, when you need to repair something, well, you call all that machinery to help do it. And that is why there is swelling, there is redness, there is, because the machinery is flowing in, there's increased blood flow, et cetera. Now, it's a brilliant acute response. It is not a good chronic response. And you know what, Amelia? I hadn't thought about this before we started recording, but because you said it's about stress, it's actually same deal with that with stress, Our stress response is excellent for acute events. And when it keeps going, just like in inflammation, it's bad news.
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. You know, your child runs on the road. You have an immediate stress response to run out and grab your child and whip them off the road, and then you recover, you take a few deep breaths, and hopefully you're not stressed anymore. Or inflammation, you roll your ankle and it's inflamed for a little while and then it calms back down. But tonight, are we mostly focusing on chronic inflammation because that's kind of where disease, a lot of disease stems from?
Yeah, exactly. So it's basically being stuck in the wrong place. That's what we're focusing on.
So I know we're going to deep dive into our biomarkers and talk through those, but before we get under the hood of our bodies, what are some signs and symptoms of inflammation that we should be kind of aware of and feeling for in our bodies?
When we talk to people, they're all giving us that already, right? So, when you wake up in the morning and you feel like your joints are squeaky, you've accumulated some fluid, everything feels a bit achy until you get going. Well, that's one of them. If you're waking up and your face is puffy and your eyes are a bit closed, and often happens if you are actually reacting, perhaps what you've eaten, some of you will call it being glutened because some of you will have that more inflammatory response to it. So that's kind of literally what it looks like. There is also, what inflammation feels like on the brain. Because there are studies saying it's literally when you're more inflamed, you're much more likely to be anxious, depressed, etc. And you'll know as you're going down with a cold or a flu, you're getting muscle aches, pains, but you're also feeling mentally worse. So that's that inflammation affecting your brain. So both as bodily and mental
Gosh, the way you
manifestations.
described it then, so visually, with our brain literally being inflamed, is incredible. I hadn't really thought of it so literally as that. But of course, if we're retaining fluid and our body is working to target particular parts of the body, we are going to feel that you know, our face is puffy, of course there's going to be a bit of extra fluid and inflammation. That's quite scary when you think about it.
Oh, you know, there are the studies where, you know, uni students are being injected pro-inflammatory compounds and they get depressed and anxious within 4 hours. I mean, I don't know who volunteers for that, but it's quite, you know, remarkable.
Oh, wow. And it's it, and so down going down the other end, when we're feeling bloated after certain foods and things like that, is that also an inflammatory response?
It doesn't have to be an inflammatory response. You may just be producing extra gas. You may have bacteria that are normally part of your microbiome, just in the wrong place, more of them in the small intestine. Small intestine is not a great container. It's floppy. It's like a plate of spaghetti. You produce gas, it distends. You may have eaten foods that are more fermentable. So it can be just something like that. It doesn't actually mean that you are necessarily, you know, have a massive inflammatory gut problem.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good distinction to know. It's great to know. All right. It's just, you know, it could be that time of the month or whatever it might be. All right. Okay. Good to know. But definitely.
Quick tip. If you want a very quick stool marker to distinguish between, you know, inflammatory bowel conditions and those that are more on the functional side, stool calprotectin, which your GP can order. That's a great marker. If your calprotectin is elevated, chances are there is some serious inflammatory stuff driving your gut problems. If it's not, that's much more likely to be irritable bowel, SIBO, other functional gut issues.
Okay, got it. I'm writing that down so I can pop that in the cheat sheet. That's great. Well, look, let's talk biomarkers because we've all got those results, and let's learn as much as we can about inflammation through our biomarkers. So it would be handy if all of you have your results handy and you can scroll to the inflammation section. I'm going to pull up a member results as well. And this member is CG is her initials. That's all I'm going to say. So, all right. So let's have a look. Where are we? Down into inflammation. For those of you that are listening, we're just scrolling to our inflammation section. Okay. So can you talk us through, Dr. Yasmina, the three main inflammatory markers that we look at in our blood results?
So first of all, CRP, right? So, and we've done high sensitivity CRP, and I just want to make a distinction, you know, between kind of a different levels of that CRP. So less than one is ideal, normal. If you are between 1 and 3, that's associated with slightly increased cardiovascular risk. There is some simmering in inflammation, you know, connected to that. If you are between 3 and 5 from a cardiovascular perspective, that is an increased risk. You need to have a look at your other markers, like markers of your blood sugar control, so insulin, HbA1c. You need to look at your cholesterol and think about it in the context. Now, in this case, when CRP is above 16, that tells me that there is some kind of significant inflammatory process going on. Whether it's coming from the gut, whether it's coming from a hidden source like periodontal disease, whether there is an underlying and autoimmune condition, I can't tell, because remember, CRP can be up with inflammation, infection. We can't distinguish, but this is beyond just background simmering inflammation. It's an active process happening.
Got it. So this, just for those of you that aren't watching and that are listening, this particular member has a CRP of 16, which, you know, I've looked at hundreds of these results and that's high. Like it's quite rare that I see them as high as this. So what you're saying is something else is going on here. It could be acute. So were they really sick at the time? Did they have a virus? And so how would this particular, if for those that have got these quite high CRP results, what would their next protocol be?
Well, again, look at the context, right? So you need to look at your full blood counts. And if you've had elevated white cell counts, that's likely that there was an infection happening at that time. This particular member also has elevated creatinine kinase, or CK. And there are lots of different reasons why CK can be elevated. We often see it in people who have exercised, you know, intensely a day or so before they're doing their blood tests. You know, it's a CK is often a marker of a muscle damage, whether it's your thigh muscle or, you know, we used to measure CK as a as, you know, sometimes as a, you know, marker of a damage of a heart muscle, etc. But often connected with exercise. But there's lots of other reasons. So thyroid, parathyroid issues can lead to elevations in the CK. So can various medications, most commonly some cholesterol-lowering medications, so statins, particularly then when statins are combined with additional lipid-lowering medications. Sometimes it can be not just exercise, but muscle trauma. You know, have you had a really good bump or a good fall? Connective tissue diseases, you know, how are your joints? So basically, the more achy you are, the more likely you are to return this elevated CK. So in other words, look at the CRP, look at the CK, look at your white cell markers, because if they are elevated, that is going to be telling you about the infection.
It might be more acute. Okay. And what about this middle marker? So lactate dehydrogenase.
Look, I don't find this as a very helpful guide. Okay. Again, lactate dehydrogenase can come from very many sources. So I concentrate on that mostly. There's a CRP, CK. I also think of insulin and look at insulin, because that LDH, that lactate dehydrogenase, can be elevated in a context of metabolic syndrome. But I can't diagnose metabolic syndrome just in the context. Ooh-hoo, here we go. I cannot diagnose metabolic syndrome just on the back of LA, lactate dehydrogenase. However, that will lead me to flip and have a look at insulin, which is what you have just done.
Yeah. So what I've done for those that are not watching and that are listening, I've now scrolled down to her metabolic markers, and we're seeing some in the red. So we're seeing a fasting insulin of 24, which is high, and a HOMA score of 4.9, which is very high, and an HbA1c of 5.5, which is on the higher end of green. So are you starting? So what are you piecing together? I can see your little brain starting to whir, and you're putting the pieces of the puzzle, the jigsaw puzzle together, Yasmina.
So when you see high insulin, when you see the HOMA IR 4.9, and remember, we really wanted it to be under 1.5, really. So that tells us about insulin resistance and significant insulin resistance. You will also remember that I said when you're running on a really high insulin, you are more likely to accumulate visceral fat, so fat around the middle, fat around the organs, fat which is very pro-inflammatory. So in this context, we are actually seeing significant metabolic inflammation. I think we probably have two sources here. We have that metabolic inflammation, and we more likely have something that's happening is more acutely, because even with these numbers, I wouldn't expect CRP of 16 just on back of the metabolic drivers.
Right. Okay. All right. That's really interesting. And I've heard you use the word metaflammation before. Mm-hmm. Is this an example of that?
Yeah, definitely. As I said, this is a certainly significant layer of it. But it's not the only component of it, I don't think, in this case.
Are there any other markers that we can use to look at our inflammation levels and to give us a bit of a gauge that we've already got on our eye screen results.
Right. So this particular number is actually tricky. Amelia, you pulled an interesting one.
Yeah.
So
I did not do that on purpose, I promise.
No. So we have somebody who's got quite a high CRP, and then you're showing me iron studies. And we have had chats in the past where I have said, well, your ferritin can be high in the context of inflammation. Mm-hmm. And that is because ferritin is supposed to be stored in your cells. And then some of it is supposed to be outside of the cells, which is what we are measuring.
Yeah.
So when you have cell injury, when you have high CRP, additional ferritin gets spilled out in the bloodstream and we measure it there. So this particular member most definitely does not have high ferritin. But
high
if you
ferritin. Her ferritin's 39, which is the lower end of green. And, you know, high, we've seen some members that have ferritin up in the 200s, which is high ferritin. And yep. What you're saying is that high ferritin can also be an indication of inflammation.
Yeah, exactly. But look at this situation here. So if you go a little bit further up, you will see that iron. So no, that's yep. So iron is quite low. So that is kind of loose iron that's available.
Yeah.
Yep. You will see. So there isn't much iron to be picked up. So you'd actually expect this ferritin to be lower than it is. So I think even at 39. This ferritin is a bit distorted. I think if we had a normal CRP, this ferritin would be lower than 39. I think it's driven up to 39 by that background inflammation.
Okay.
Right. So yes, that is why it's really, really important that when we look at iron studies, we also take into account what's happening with those inflammatory markers, because that there's certainly a contribution to, you know, how you interpret them.
Okay. All right. So bringing it back to the main markers, what you're saying is we've been talking about quite a high inflammation. We're basically focusing on these three main ones that are in our inflammation section. Plus, you can maybe look at high ferritin as another hint as well. What about just simmering inflammation? So what about those of us that are in between that CRP of kind of, you know, 1 to 3, for example? What is that telling us if our CRP is sitting kind of between that, you know, 1 to 3?
So you asked me, you know, how can we think about it better? Like, is there anything else?
Mm.
And there is another measure. We don't have it available to us because there's a protein called globulin that we don't have in our tests. Mm-hmm. But there is a ratio that we call albumin to globulin ratio, and it's supposed to be about 1.5. If it is lower than 1.2, then it's again another marker of inflammatory processes. And basically, you know, inflammation leads to damage of albumin, so albumin goes down. Inflammation also leads to higher globulin, so that goes up, so that ratio changes. So it is it is another marker that I look at when people go, but I have pretty normal CRP and other things are fairly normal. I just don't feel right. So that's another thing to kind of peek under the hood when things are a bit more complex.
Okay, because you basically just answered my next question, which was, if our inflammation markers look pretty normal, but we're feeling some of those symptoms we spoke about earlier, about the squeaky joints and can't get your rings off and the puffiness, you're saying that there are some other markers you can go back. You can still be inflamed even if those markers, the CRP, CK, etc., are
yes.
a little bit elevated. Right.
Yep, you can.
Okay.
And so that is just, but you know what? So that's just, you know, answer the first part of the question. You know, do I have a biomarker that can confirm, I guess, you know, it can tell me that I'm not mad, that this inflamed thing, we can turn it into some sort of number, right? Remember, this is a tool. If you are feeling inflamed, I believe you. I don't necessarily have to have a number, and we don't understand everything, right? And I think at some point you just really, really need to hear the story. But it is another, you know, if we are looking at numbers, this is another number, another little, you know, I guess a road sign that we can use. Yeah.
And you can always go back and look at some of your old bloods and look for that albumin globulin ratio that should be essentially 1 to 5 albumin to globulin.
1.5. So take your albumin divided by globulin, and that should be 1.5 or greater.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
We'll have it in the cheat sheet.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. All right. But CRP is kind of like the hero one, right? So that is a pretty big catcher's mitt that catches a large majority of inflammation. So that's kind of the one that we should be watching closely. And so, all right, so let's say we are in more of that simmering, that 1 to 3 category. What are some of the causes of inflammation? What is going on here?
All right. Well, let's go first to the ones that are sort of, you know, really, really obvious suspects. So smoking, for everyone who is still smoking, quitting smoking is probably the best thing you can do for your health. Alcohol is another, you know, well-known suspect. You will know what you feel like after a big night and what your joints feel like. Diet, we have spent a lot of time talking about diet in inner vitality. Actually, lack of exercise. And even for you who have arthritis, osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis or any kind of arthritis, psoriatic, reactive, doesn't matter. Exercise does help. The right kind of exercise in the right amount, but it does actually help. Because it moves that synovial fluid out of your joints, moves them around. It leads to better function. You will feel better. Lack of sleep. That's a big one. And then there are, you know, hidden sources. And one of them
I just jump into lack of sleep for a moment? Is that because when we sleep, our body rests, restores, it rebuilds, it repairs? And so if we're not getting enough sleep or we're not getting good quality sleep, literally our body's just unable to make all those repairs that it should be. And so therefore things remain inflamed or don't get, detoxified as efficiently as, say, someone who's sleeping really well.
Well, there's that, but there is the metabolic effect of lack of sleep. So remember, when you don't have enough sleep, your cortisol is higher, which means your blood sugar is higher, which means your insulin is higher, which means you're driving that metabolic inflammation, right?
Wow.
So
all comes back to metabolic health, doesn't it?
It does. It does, right? And, you know, again, the sleep is connected to your immune function as well. So you all know what happens if you've been running low on sleep. You know that you crash out eventually. So,
yeah. Okay, I stopped you. You were on a roll there. Sorry, I just wanted to deep dive. So you said sleep. What else is causing this inflammation in us?
Right, so gut issues. And it can be, you know, what we call, you know, people talk about gut permeability or leaky gut, but basically the cells that form your gut lining are supposed to be fairly tightly held together. When they, and their connections are looser, it's like a loose shoelaces. Mm-hmm. So whatever you are eating, the proteins are not supposed to be crossing on the other side. They do that to a greater extent. Your immune system is patrolling. It's basically calling stranger danger. Response to stranger danger is inflammation, right? So, and some of the very simple things that you can do is just check for gut parasites. With simple parasites can make you more susceptible to this.
What
And
about
then,
just on that as well? I've heard, and I'd love you to confirm, as we get older, our digestive enzymes don't necessarily function as well. So suddenly the foods that we're eating and chewing and that are going into our tummies, the enzymes that break down that food so that by the time it gets into our gut, it's in the right broken down forms, it's not actually working as efficiently because those digestive enzymes aren't doing their job properly. So then you're getting these kind of larger chunks. Is that true? I'd love your thoughts on this
yeah,
concept
so
of digestive enzymes.
you need good stomach acid to activate your digestive enzymes, right? So they're produced by a pancreas in inactive form, and then they get activated in your digestive system, right? And when you have low stomach acid, that first lot of digestive enzymes that work inside your stomach are not as effective because they haven't been activated. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, you know what? We rush, so we don't chew. So if you don't chew properly, the whole process is a lot more difficult. You're asking your stomach and your digestive enzymes basically to attack bigger chunks of food, quite literally. So the process is more difficult. So you'll be actually surprised how many, those digestive issues actually improve. When you sit down, you chew, you take your time.
Eat slowly. Yeah, okay. It's amazing to think how this, like, we're talking about digestive enzymes, but in relationship to gut permeability and inflammation, and how it's all, and then chewing slowly, and how that can actually have an impact on inflammation. All right. So, yes. So, you said so gut issues can be a cause of inflammation. And I got that. Any other kind of more hidden causes that we might not think about?
You know what? Periodontal disease is actually quite a big hidden cause. So, people with gum disease, that's what it is, have inc 3 to 4 times greater risk of cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, right?
That is just
It
crazy.
is crazy.
And how do we know if we have gum disease? Is it when we're flossing and a lot of blood comes out when in between our teeth when we're flossing? Is that a sign of gum
Well,
disease?
that's one of the signs, but basically, when you know how they say getting long in the tooth? So
Oh,
basically, those gums kind
no.
of migrating up and so teeth looking longer. That's a very classic sign, right? Oh, you can do that.
Oh, am I getting long in the
Right. So we don't know that exact link, but we know that periodontal disease increases body's burden of inflammation.
I'm
And
going to
it's
the dentist and
really,
asking if I've got any signs of gum disease, that's for sure.
and and again, the most simple thing you can do is you can have regular dental checks with, cleaning, removing the plaque and making sure that you're not growing bacteria between your teeth and your gums. It's a really, really interesting because when they look at people who have a predisposition to rheumatoid arthritis, and when that rheumatoid arthritis kind of reemerges, there's a correlation with that oral microbiome and periodontal disease. So, lots of things to be worked out, but it is certainly something to look at. And then there are, because especially, the people from Queensland, people from Sydney, people whose houses have been affected by, floods, who lived through
Or old,
incredible
if you're in the
humidity.
UK and you're either in a, underground, a flat, what are they
Those
called?
low flats,
The
yep.
low
So
flats or a
looking at
very
people's
old
feet.
building. You're going to say mold and bacteria, aren't you?
Yeah. So and if you figure out, you know, you walk into a secondhand clothing store and you get sort of hit by that musty smell and all of a sudden you are reacting. If you go into someone's house and you can smell that musty thing and then you are reacting, you should really seriously think about that mold exposure and how that's affecting you, because some people are very sensitive and get triggered by that.
Okay. So that's quite a lot of essentially causes of inflammation. But if we're going to sum these up to kind of, you know, the key major ones, would you say that carrying a lot of visceral fat around the middle can be probably one of the biggest drivers, which is, you know, one of the biggest ways to reduce your inflammation, and one of the biggest ways to drive it up is by when that weight migrates to the middle.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then diet is the other really big driver, as in if you're having a diet that's very high in those pro-inflammatory foods, which are often your ultra processed foods, or, you know, your very high glycemic index, refined carbohydrates, your cakes, your biscuits, your fried food. They're probably we've spoken about lots of them, but they're probably the two biggest levers that you can pull to reducing your inflammation. Yeah.
Yep, definitely. Okay. So that kind of stuff is that's what we're working on. That's what is totally within reach.
And so I guess that's a good a good segue in that if you're suffering, if you've got those two things going on, as in your diet's not ideal and you're carrying a lot of weight around the middle, I wouldn't be going and spending $5,000 getting your house demolded straight away, although that might be useful. You'd be better off really nailing your diet and your visceral fat. So I want to just talk about autoimmune conditions like, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, Hashi's, celiac, Crohn's, Graves, psoriasis, like lots of our members have got some autoimmune conditions going on. It's also important to note that the rate of autoimmune disease diagnosis increases with age in women in particular. And this can often be because of, you know, hormonal changes, immune system changing, genetics, aging, etc. But Dr. Yasmina, what does inflammation have to do with these autoimmune conditions?
Look, autoimmune conditions are really, really complex. And so there's, you know, lots of overlapping factors. It's almost like that's, you know, a Swiss cheese model where you kind of have to line up the holes. And when they do line up, that's how you get to a particular undesirable outcome, right? So there is certainly a genetic predisposition. And those of you who have an autoimmune diagnosis often can think of family members who have it as well. But there's definitely a genetic predisposition. Then there are, you know, there's a myriad of environmental triggers. So again, I have quite a number of patients who will say, and then I had this gut problem and then it started. And often, you know, there is I will have patients who have a lingering gut issues, have it for a while, but it's really, you know, joint problems, aches, pains that have led them to make that appointment. And, you know, they're not putting the gut thing to the forefront, but when you hear the whole story, you go, aha. So there is a link, and we now know that there are actually disturbances in the microbiome. There are some organisms that are potential autoimmune triggers. There are features of gut permeability that when they line up, they can actually serve as that trigger for the autoimmune condition to develop on that background of genetic predisposition, right? And then there is the peak time for autoimmune diagnoses in women is that perimenopause, menopause. So again, We know that there are hormonal changes, fluctuations that somehow modulate our immune system. That leads to, you know, dysregulation. And again, for some of you who have had autoimmune diagnoses, you know, before your pregnancy, that's really typical of rheumatoid arthritis, you know, fibromyalgia, etc. You may have had a honeymoon period or the, you know, improvement in symptoms during your pregnancy, and then significant worsening of the condition in the postnatal period. So again, demonstrates the, you know, the role that female hormones play in modulation of immune system.
Okay. So will reducing our inflammation levels help to either manage our autoimmune condition, or for those of us that are now feeling nervous as we're approaching menopause, that menopause might trigger these, will reducing inflammation help to ward off some of these autoimmune conditions from emerging?
Yeah, I mean, if we knew surefire what would prevent an autoimmune condition, it would be amazing. I mean, we don't have anything that can guarantee you that you will not develop it. But we know that overall, you know, anti-inflammatory diet lifestyle that basically is aimed at reducing background inflammation improves outcome even in people who do have autoimmune conditions. It all depends on what your baseline is. You know, if your baseline is right here and then you have a flare, well, that flare can be quite incapacitating. So if your baseline is there and then you have a flare, then even during that flare, you can cope, you can function. You're still at the level where you can use that toolbox and pull yourself up. So
when you're talking baselines, are you essentially talking about inflammation? Like if you can keep your inflammation at a really low baseline, then yep, surely that's going to have a dampening effect on either bringing on an autoimmune condition or your existing condition flaring up.
Correct. Which is exactly what, even when we give people medications, that's what we're trying to do. We don't take away inflammation altogether, but we lower that baseline. And, you know, I am all for using everything that we can out of the toolbox, from, you know, diet to lifestyle to supplements to medications if needed to achieve that.
Mm. It's funny because my sister, who's 8 years older, has Graves' disease. My dad, who's type 2 diabetic, had half his thyroid removed, and I think he's got some autoimmune thing going on as well. And so I'm like, guys, they're all dropping like flies around me. I need, you know, it's nice to go, okay, if I can, you know, implement some of these lifestyle habits, if I can keep tracking my inflammation markers and hoping that they're staying below that simmering level, then hopefully I'm keeping all those bad genetics at bay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, supplements. Okay. We're sitting here. We're going, yep, I'm a bit simmery. I'm a bit inflamed. I'm doing Dr. Yasmina and Amelia's protocols, and I'm sleeping better, and I'm eating well, and I'm exercising as best I can. Can we get a little bit of a nudge with some supplements? What do you recommend?
Okay. So again, food first, right? And I love berries. You can have frozen berries. You can even buy frozen organic berries from, you know, sometimes even from wholesalers. Fill up your freezer. Have that with a bit of your skyr, which is a protein rich, brilliant. So antioxidants.
Pop them like a pill. They feel like the capsule. Just pretend it's a supplement, a berry supplement you're putting in your mouth.
Oily fish, again, so that's your EPA, DHA. If you don't like it, then yes, you can go supplements. And for those who, you know, because there's been so much press about fish oil and what fish oil, etc., If you want to check that you're getting your omega index right, now you can purchase through even Metagenics. You can purchase those little test cards. They're going to show you omega-3 index. So you
I
will.
don't follow. Can you just quickly explain that, what you
Yeah.
mean?
So it's about the balance between omega-3s and omega-6s. If we want to be, if we want to simplify things, omega-3 good guys, omega-6 bad guys, right? There are tests, do them at home. You do the finger prick at home and then send them away, and they will give you omega-3 index. So it will tell you if you are sufficiently supplemented, basically, in omega-3s.
Right. Okay. So this is a literally a finger prick test, or you can get a blood test as well to see what your omega threes, but you're saying it gives you an index to, as in like a ratio between three and six, does it? Okay. Okay. All right. So you can actually get that test done. Oh, that's interesting.
Curcumin, another really, really nice and simple anti-inflammatory.
Do
It
you have
does
a
matter
particular brand you
how you.
like?
Sorry?
Do you have a particular brand you like of curcumin?
Bioceuticals have a good, I think it's called the Theracumin Triple or something like that. It's a good one. Biomedica have a really good curcumin formulation as well. It matters how you have it. So again, with your curcumin, with your fish oil, with your vitamin D, if you're taking oral ones, take them with the fatty meals, right? Much, much better absorption. So and that my next one is NAC. So
NAC.
N-acetylcysteine. Yep. And that gets turned into glutathione, which is the most powerful antioxidant that your body has. And again, if you like it in a capsule form, Biomedica has it's called Veggie NAC. So people seem to prefer that as to just a simple powdered form. And then there are substances called resolvents. Metagenics have a supplement they call SBM Active. It's basically resolvents. So you can think about it as the most potent anti-inflammatory component of fish oil. That's what fish oils kind of get metabolized into. The reason they're called resolvents because they basically act as a molecular messengers that say, hey, this inflammatory process should be done by now. Everybody go home, calm down, let's get back to the baseline. So resolvents I often use in a context where I go, okay, we need an intervention that will last maybe 4 weeks or so. I have used it even in the sports people when the tendons flare up, when there are some tendinopathies flaring up. I've used it for plantar fasciitis, also in people. I've used it in the context of endometriosis, etc. So SBM resolvents are quite a good
Okay,
sort
so
of.
if a member listening has got that simmering inflammation, how would you recommend? You've mentioned the three supplements, the curcumin, the NAC, and the SBM resolvents. Do they take all three? Do they cycle them? What's the protocol? What would you recommend for the simmerers?
Curcumin is a baseline, right? So again,
Couple of
goes food to
months,
food.
just yeah, food
Yeah,
first.
curcumin is food first. Follow what we're suggesting in terms of diet. Make sure your vitamin D is sufficient because you remember vitamin D regulates hundreds of genes that are involved in inflammation. So diet first, make sure vitamin D is sufficient. Next, comes in curcumin. If your HbA1c is as high, so it's an indicator of oxidative stress as well, then your NAC comes in. SBM resolvents, they are to me shorter term intervention. that can come up when you're having flares. If you want something as a baseline, and it's your regular fish oil, you don't need it to be SPM resolvents. But if you are having, if you're having a flares, then SPMs can be a great thing to bring in the shorter term.
Okay, got it. And okay, so curcumin's kind of one you can almost kind of take all the time.
Yep, definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
And remember, you don't have to be confined to supplement. You can have a supplement on the baseline, but you use it in your cooking. You make your golden milk with a you know,
turmeric.
Whatever milk you, or substitute you want, and some curcumin and some cinnamon and, you know, some ginger. It's beautiful. So it has started as spice. You can still use it in all of those ways, in addition to using it as a supplement.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Yasmina. That's super, super helpful. All right, are you ready to switch gears? We're going to move on to part two. Okay, shake off our inflammation. I hope everyone, you're all still with us. Just giving my joints a little bit of a feel, making sure I'm not too inflamed. Stress. Oh my goodness. Chronic stress. First of all, I guess, are there any biomarkers in particular? I don't think there's any markers that we are measuring an eye screen, but
no.
Can we actually measure our stress levels and whether our bodies are we stressed? Is it affecting us physically, physiologically, or is it just my brain that's feeling stressed?
Right. So let's go back to biomarkers. And we've had lots of discussions around this. And you're saying, can we measure cortisol? Like, no, not in a useful way. Because
I tried, guys. I really tried.
she did. But not in a useful way, because cortisol is changing levels throughout the day. It's supposed to peak within half an hour of waking, and then it's supposed to decrease during the day, hitting its minimum as you're getting ready to sleep. It's a seesaw hormone. So as the cortisol falls, your melatonin is supposed to rise, etc. So just having one snapshot in time tells you precisely nothing. So if you want to know about cortisol, you need to look at curves. So cortisol curves that are measured, you know, about 5 or 6 samples through the day, usually in saliva. And even then, you've got to be really careful how you're measuring it, because you need to look not just at that active cortisol, you need to look at the metabolites. I usually do the Dutch test for it. But as I said, it is not something that is practical to do in this context.
But I do want to just touch on the Dutch test. And first of all, can you explain what the Dutch test is? And secondly, what sort of a profile of a patient would you send for a Dutch test?
Well, there are different components of a Dutch test. So I usually do what's called Dutch Plus. One is when we're looking at this cortisol metabolism. So that's people with chronic fatigue who think, you know, who come to me and say that either they are constantly wired and tired, or people who are just flat on the couch can't get off. So we tend to look at their cortisol metabolism.
Okay,
the
so
other part
can of- I just say, so those of you members who are flat on the couch and absolutely exhausted, and you've seen your biomarkers and your iron's good, your vitamin D's good, those micronutrients like protein, magnesium, all of those are good. There's no red flags in your biomarkers and you're flat on the couch. That potentially could be someone, Yasmina, that if they came to you as a patient, you would get that you would ask them to do the Dutch test. It's not a blood test though, is it? It's a urine
No.
test.
It's a combination of urine and saliva. Yeah.
But there's a catch, right? Because it's a bucket of urine. Is that right?
Yeah, you're collecting urine and saliva through the day. So, you know, it's a...
you need your milk carton of urine to take back. All right. And so what do you get when you do this test? What, as a doctor, what can you tell from this test?
So there's two other components. So one is when we look at the hormone metabolism. And so that's how you metabolize estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. So that's kind of the second part.
Interesting for perimenopause, menopause to have a deep dive into what your hormones are telling you.
Very interesting for people who have family history of or personal history of breast cancer, because that can tell us how you metabolize estrogen. And there are things that we can do to help you metabolize it in a healthier way. And the third part is organic acids. I call them really like a little molecular crumbs. And they are metabolites that you're looking at. And if they're high, low, they can tell you, point you towards the biochemical pathways that are jammed, put it that way. So that test is definitely not, the first kind of thing we do. So let's say it's about a third line test, but it's helpful for people who are really troubleshooting fatigue, adrenal functioning. It's helpful for people who are struggling with their hormones, with HRT, with perhaps even PCOS, with who have had issues with breast cancer, family history of breast cancer. And the organic acids is when it's like, geez, we've done everything. Where do we look? What, are there any road signs here? So that's kind of the context that we're doing it in.
Okay, and relating all this back to stress, doing a test like that, does it tell you essentially how stressed you are?
It can be, but you know what? But one of the frustrating things is that you can do the test and it can tell you, well, we've got all the biochemical evidence that you are stressed. Now what next? And yes, we can, there are certain adrenal adaptogens that you can put in the in a, that help adrenal function, adaptation, etc. But you can't supplement entirely your way out of stress. There are still things
No.
that you
And it's a
need to
bit of, it
do
is,
and
because
change.
it's a quite an expensive test, right? It's like what, $400 or
It's a
$300,
$500 test, yeah.
$500, right? So it's a bit of a like, oh, no shit, Sherlock. Like, did I really have to pay $500 to say, yes, I can confirm that you're stressed? But
It does give you more than that. It does give you some tools, but again, you cannot supplement your way entirely out of a bad diet, out of unsustainable lifestyle, out of, things that perhaps you have had in your life that need addressing. Supplementation, lifestyle changes can help, but oftentimes we do come to those things that, well, we didn't really want to address, but we do need to address to move on to that next level.
Okay. Well, that's really good to know that there is a test like that out there and available. And by the way, guys, like Yasmina and I were talking about the possibility of running some kind of other program using, because there is so much you can learn from a Dutch test using
Yeah.
that. So if you heard this and you're like, oh, that sounds really interesting, pop over into the community hub and start a conversation about it, because I'd be curious to know if it's something that interests you guys. And maybe we could find a cheaper one. It's not going to be a lot cheaper, but anyway, I'd like to touch on another way to measure your stress levels that's cheap and available if you have a smartwatch, a wearable like an Apple Watch or a Whoop or something like that. And that's heart rate variability. And this can be a really useful tool to track how stressed you are. And I think I've discussed it in a previous video, but I'll just super quickly describe what it is. And I want to show you an image of one of my clients' heart rate variability changes through a program. Okay, so basically, it's the amount of time between successive heartbeats. And when you are relaxed and not stressed, the time varies quite a bit between heartbeats. But when you're stressed, and your cardiovascular system is kind of tense, think of it like that, your heart beats like a metronome, okay? And the variability is not very high. So the lower your heart rate variability, the more stressed you are, and the higher your heart rate variability, the less stressed you are. So If you have an Apple Watch, you will and you wear it, you will have your heart rate variability already available. So you just go into the little health app, which is you just search your apps, type in health, you'll see a little white app pop up with a red heart, and then just look for heart rate variability. You can press like over the last 6 months or over the last week or over the last month. I'll show you. This is just one. I'm going to be in a TV show in a couple of months. And so this is an example of someone for the client for the show that I'm working on. So can you see here, you can see back here in November where the heart rate variability was below 50. So it was quite low. It's looking like it was in the 20s. And then as this person has implemented these programs and they're getting fitter and they're doing box breathing and they're doing all their stress management, you can see that heart rate variability slowly climbing, which is a really great sign that their body is under less stress. So yeah, if you have a wearable, start tracking. And ideally your sleeping heart rate variability is more accurate than your waking, but that's another one you can look at. So there you
look,
go.
I really like HIV. I think in my experience, it's got a very good correlation. And it's a very objective tool, you know, because you know some of us can be very, very disconnected from, you know, what it is to be stressed, you know. I'm prone to saying, yeah, totally fine, absolutely fine, no problem in the world. And you look at it and even in the hindsight, when you look at your HIV data, you know, over some of the past month, you're saying, oh, that really was not okay. And in the hindsight, I can see that. But when you're in the middle of those things, you don't always realize what's happening to you.
Absolutely. And you've got this concept of kind of the stresses in your life today. But what about past traumas as well? What about things that have happened in, you know, in our lives that might either be triggering for us today? I mean, Yasmina, I know that you've experienced trauma firsthand in your life. Do you mind sharing and how you have kind of learnt to manage and live with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's actually sort of fairly good demonstration of both of how you adapt and how you don't read yourself very well. So, I was, you know, 14 living in Sarajevo in Bosnia. I was an elite skier. I had the best life ever. You know, I was showing up at school to do my assessments the rest of the time, traveling, training through Europe, etc. You know, and then the war happens and then you have nothing. And then, you know, I spent 12 months in Sarajevo during the war where snipers shot at you while you were queuing for water, no food, you know, losing friends, relatives to shelling, you know, an average of 350 artillery shells a day, that kind of thing, right?
Oh my God.
So fast forward, I did get out of there. I did get to Australia, did, you know, lived life. And then, you know, even about, so that was when I was 14, and even about 18 months ago, I'm having a chat with a friend, who he also is from Sarajevo and who is a psychologist. And I think, you know, that war thing, I don't think that really affected me. I think I pretty much just, and she said, so do you think it's actually, you know, normal to think that, you know, tomorrow you can wake up and everything that you have, as in, you know, family, materially, then it's all gone? I was like, yeah, that can happen to anyone. She says, you know, that is not normal. It's really interesting how we can live those things, how we can adapt, how we can survive, how we can, you know, and how we can tell ourselves stories to explain how we react and we can normalize it. And so sometimes, and you know, perimenopause, menopause is really a time when a lot of that somehow comes back to us. And there is a now building literature saying that perimenopause, menopause is a time of what they call brain refurbishment. And somehow, in the midst of that, people revisit those traumatic experiences in their lives. And I can't tell you how often I have patients and, you know, I mean, I've had to revisit some of that stuff. It is a time of our life where we kind of need to go back there in a safe way with somebody that we trust to work through that, to make that progress in other spheres of our life. So again, not something that's entirely understood, but watch this space and, you know, question yourself and talk to people that you trust, because just as I've told you, the stories that you tell yourself are there to help you adapt and survive, but they're not necessarily there to help you thrive right through.
So if there's a member listening now who says, wow, I've got some past traumas that I can feel are kind of sitting there and they're either, you know, coming back up, or I can feel they're on the verge of coming back up. What advice would you have for them to help make sure that that doesn't manifest itself in a physical ill health way, be it through stress, anxiety, depression, or some physical expression of that?
Look, there are things that you can do for yourself, and there are things that you actually need somebody else to help you with. What you can do for yourself, and this, you know, often seeing somebody also comes to financial decisions, etc., is a lot of things that we're giving you, even just the breathing exercises, even, you know, when we mentioned sort of vagus stimulation, so even like a gargling, a meditation, all of that, that's activating parasympathetic system. And you have parasympathetic system, which is calming, and you have sympathetic nervous system, which is there to respond to stress. You cannot have both of them up at the same time. It's seesaw, it's one or the other. So all of these things that we're giving you to activate your parasympathetic system are there to bring that stress response down. So even if you are not in a position to go and deep dive where you need to, you can actually create conditions where your nervous system is calming. Even things like, you know, for me, exercise is essential. Nature exposure is essential. I have to go into the mountains. I have to spend time with my dog. It's as simple as that, right?
That's your Prozac.
That's my Prozac. I mean, everybody's got their thing, you know?
Yeah.
But that's mine. And then if you can, and if you feel like you're at the place to, finding somebody that you can trust to talk to. And I often say to people, it might not happen in the first 1, 2, 3 sessions. It might not happen with the first or second person. But when you find somebody that you can work with, they can make a real difference. So just because it hasn't worked in the past, it doesn't mean that it will not work next time, because, you know, you need to be in the right spot. You need to find the right person. You know, it's always an option. It's always worth giving it a go. And it doesn't, you know, it can be all, it doesn't have to be a psychologist. It can be psychotherapist. It can be a counselor. There's the people come in with all sorts of qualifications. You just need to find somebody who fits with you.
That clicks as well. Even I'm a very forward thinking and a proactive person. And I remember once I went and saw a life coach, and it was, you know, more about kind of goal setting and things like that. But it was amazing how it still linked back to my past, and it was still so healing for me as well. But I preferred that approach to it because I was kind of like all about improving the future. And look, they're all fantastic tips. And I'd love to spend the last few minutes now talking about stress management strategies that we can take away. And those of you watching or listening, I'd love you to pop in the community hub if you've had some success with whether it be psychotherapy or dealing with some of these past traumas and stressors. We'd love to hear your story. Let us know in the community what worked for you. And I just want to circle back to something that you said, which I think is such a great point about this autonomic nervous system. So your parasympathetic, your rest and digest, we want to dial that up. We want to dial down the sympathetic fight or flight. And I love this concept that I heard a Dr. Oscar Serilach talk about, which was, he said, small things often, medium things sometimes, and large things occasionally. And what he meant was, for stress management, small things often is your, exactly what you were just mentioning, Yasmina. So box breathing is a favorite one. So deep breathing, you know, and then it's a great idea to habit stack it. So you time it with another habit. So for example, as I go to sleep at night, I'm going to do 2 minutes of box breathing, or when I'm standing under the shower, or as soon as my hands get on the steering wheel, I'm going to sit there and do my box breathing. So that's the small things, like multiple times throughout the day, those deep breaths that connects you to that vagus nerve and to that autonomic system. And then medium things sometimes, that's where it might be a 20-minute meditation, you know, YouTube video or a pod meditation. Calm app is a great one. Headspace is another great one. And that might be a couple of times a week. So medium things sometimes. And then you've got the large things occasionally, where you do go and book that health retreat or book a massage or, you know, sauna and cold plunge or whatever your thing is. But don't wait, because a lot of us go, oh, in 3 months' time, I'm going to go on that holiday and that retreat, and that's going to be my stress release. You'd be better off box breathing three times a day and skipping the retreat.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's and you can just pick something that you enjoy. This is not something to be, you know, we don't want to add another chore. Just pick something you enjoy. I know all the benefits of meditation. I know that it's amazing, but I don't like it. So
I'll go
and in the mountain with my dog. That's my meditation.
I'm so glad you said that, because I have tried meditation so many times, and it just, I'm the same as you, Dr. Yasmin. And I have so much respect, because for all of you that are meditators and do it so well, like, keep going, and more power to you.
Absolutely.
But I'm the same as you, Yasmina. I'm like, jogging.
I know all the benefits. I want the benefits. I'd love to be able to do it. I just haven't been, you know, I've tried many times, but it's always felt like a chore. So I have another way of getting there.
Yeah. Another great stress management technique I'd love you to consider, and I'd also love you to think of Yasmina's idea of trying it a few times, and that is writing therapy. And there's a great BBC podcast, it's only 15 minutes long, with Michael Mosley, that talks about the research through, and writing therapy is quite broad. So it can be literally sitting down and just writing your thoughts out, versus following some set frameworks. And I've given you guys some examples of writing therapy. So the five to thrive activity, those five questions that I prompt you with, and also the self-belief suitcase activity, which are a bunch of other questions when you've got these self-limiting beliefs. They're and other examples of writing it out, but actually having that writing and that ritual of or it could be gratitude as well, is one I'd love you to try too. Have you got any others? I mean, we've spoken exercise, got the breathing, we've got the writing. Supplements?
Animals. I've spoken about dogs.
Yeah.
But animals are amazing. Like, you know, the nature exposure. So Japanese, they call it the forest bathing. They measured cortisol levels of people after nature exposure. Cortisol falls significantly on the nature exposure. We know, again, from lots of studies, exposure to animals, actually touching animals, has an amazing effect on heart rate variability, in fact.
What
So all those
about
things are quite easily accessible.
scrolling on Instagram at 11:30 at night and watching cat videos? Does that count? Because
I don't know. Until you said cat videos, I was like, no. But maybe if you're laughing your head off, maybe, I don't know.
Oh, well, look, Yasmina, to wrap up, if there's a member watching, listening to this tonight, that's like, yes, okay, now I want to
They're
really
not watching,
focus.
they've gone to cat videos.
They've gone to cat videos. Oh gosh, sorry guys, but really, we're getting to the end now, aren't we? What is a parting tip or message? What should this member do if they're like, right, I want to tackle this stress? What would you recommend they kind of go off and do?
All right, so magnesium morning and night, right? It is that the more stressed you are, the more magnesium you're losing, the more magnesium depleted you are, the worse your stress and coping is, and your sleep is. So magnesium morning at night, and as you take your magnesium go for that bottle, remember to do your breathing exercises. That is
Oh,
a total of 4 minutes a day.
good
That's
idea.
total of 4 minutes a day. That's it.
Magnesium and box breathing. What a combination. All right.
There
I'm feeling less stressed already. Thank you, Dr. Yasmina.
you go. No worries.
Oh, thank you all so much for sticking with us. I hope you got something out of that. Check out the cheat sheet, and we will be back with another video very, very soon. See you, Yasmina.
See you. Thank you all for your time again. See ya.